Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Global Math Department. You're going to hear from Jose Luis Wilson, and he's going to talk to us about writing, since he has quite a bit of experience. Jose, actually, before I start, I want to let you know a little bit about this particular recording and how it works on Global Math Department. At the end of the hour, it will take a little bit of time, but it will load up, and if you missed a piece of it, or you would like to come back and hear it again, or definitely recommend it to someone who missed the presentation tonight, then they can come back to the same link. While you're waiting for Jose to start talking, if you could go ahead and introduce yourselves in the chat window, telling us what you teach, where, what your Twitter handle is, if you have one. That would be spectacular if you would go ahead and do that right now.
I see Wendy. Hi, Wendy. that's my partner in crime, my math for America. I was telling you about the racially relevant pedagogy workshops over there, and they've been excellent. And not because we hosted it, but because she hosted it. Really, she's probably blushing over there. Yes. How you doing? Assalam, homie. All these cool kids.
Spectacular.
Yes.
Introduce yourselves, guys. I am going to move it along because I know Jose wants to have as much time to answer your questions as possible. Know that the chat room is available for both practical and general conversations. As you post your questions, then Jose is rapid fire answering. I will also be catching those and putting them in a place so he can double check to make sure he doesn't miss any questions. So hopefully none of your questions get missed. So without further ado, I do want to introduce properly Jose Luis Wilson. Jose is a middle school math teacher in New York City. He is also the founder of EduColor, an organization of educators and concerned citizens dedicated to equity and social justice. He writes regularly at thejosewilson.com, and he also has a book entitled This Is Not a Test, A New Narrative on Race, which I have read, and it is fabulous. I highly recommend it. You can find him on Twitter at TheJOSEWV, and as I said, he's going to be answering your questions live as you post them. Additionally, he, as I said, has a website that he maintains at thejosewilson.com. So, without further ado, I will let Jose take it away.
Hi, my name is Jose Wilson. it always feels weird. I feel like I should be standing up and having people say hi back to me. One of the things you all should know is that for the last few days, I've taken a seriously long break from social media. And the only reason I mentioned that is, specifically Facebook and Twitter. And the reason why I mentioned that in this specific space is because I think there are times when it's important to be on those spaces, and that's cool. And then there are times when you really have to organize your thoughts and try to figure out ways to shut out the noise. And as you're probably well aware, there's a whole ton of noise out there these days. And that's kind of what I want to couch this idea of writing on. What I found is that over the last 11 years, writing has been one of the most powerful tools, if not the most powerful tool, for reflecting and elevating my voice, but then also using those efforts to multiply for so many others. What is perhaps the most poignant piece here, too, is that I think for us math teachers, we're often relegated to the corners because, unlike our English counterparts, I find that so many of us are B-type personalities, where we're willing to let others lead Because we have our own little thing that we're going to go have fun with. Like, I remember being at Twitter math camp, for instance, and I just looked around and it just felt like everybody's just so chill. Everyone felt like, yeah, you know, we're kind of just learning here. It's cool. We'll get it done. And we all trust each other's intelligences versus folks that I've been with in, I guess, English or humanities or subjects. There's a lot of flaunting of knowledge and names thrown around, et cetera, and very much being like, we have to be task-oriented and put ourselves out there, really be loud about our profession. So in terms of this writing thing, right, I think math teachers have a grand opportunity time and again to illustrate the ways in which we teach math that matters. What I mean by that is there's always this conversation about real life math, but we rarely have the same conversation around English. So in this country, we are perfectly okay with kids being enumerate as long as they're not a math person, but we're not okay with kids being illiterate. And we never say, oh, that kid is not an English person, right? So the ways in which we can illustrate to the general public that not only does math actually matter, but even the things that look like they don't matter actually make kids more well-rounded can be a powerful tool, a powerful agent for the work that we're doing here. This especially matters across racial and gender lines and class lines as well. You know, far too many classrooms, for instance, where girls are told time and again that math isn't their subject, that they're not very good at math, or that Latino students or that Black students or our Muslim students aren't as good because they either speak a different language or they have a different approach to the math. And that's another conversation to have. I think one of the things that I have found powerful by writing and putting those thoughts out there is that I think we've built more consensus around this idea that we don't necessarily have to approach math in one specific way. We can do this in multiple ways and allow for as many people and opportunities to come in, to draw folks in into the math work that we do. That's my foundation for some of this work. Is this where I do y'all want me to keep talking? I'm trying to figure out where I'm at and all that. Okay, here's something. I would like for everyone to just in the chat box, can you tell me if you have a blog or not? If you do, just let me know. Yes, and you can link it too if you wish. That's one. Yes, Her Mathness, of course. That's two. Not presently considering it. Okay, good. That's good. Ah, of course. That's, yeah. I've seen that. Okay. Anyone else? Well, I mean, I think the point of us sharing those pieces, I want to just make sure I get a sense of what the room is like so I can couch my thoughts from there. One of the things people ought to know is that back when I started about 11, 12 years ago, there weren't as many blogs as there are now. And there weren't as many, I guess, platforms, if you will, and it wasn't quite as easy as it was. So when I started, I found myself looking for spaces that were low stakes. So those of you who are familiar with Zanga, for example, that's where I started writing. And I was writing anonymously through there. And then eventually people said, well, I think you're good enough for you to get your own platform. So that's where the Jose Wilson came from, not from a point of arrogance, but from a point of, I need to find a voice out here because there's a lot of noise. And at that point, I still felt there was a lot of noise, not enough conversation around education. And these days, it's even more critical to do that, right? So one thing people should know, those of you who do not have a blog, you may want to start from having a blog that's low stakes, meaning you may want to create your own WordPress, the WordPress.com, a blog space, or Blogspot, if you will. Any of those platforms where you're not highly invested per se and you can delete it automatically, that may be the way to go. Because if you're not trying to do something too extravagant, then it's low stakes. You write what you will. Maybe you're not expecting a huge audience. Maybe you just want to contribute here and there whenever there are mass conversations. That could be something that I think would be a good intro, just to get a sense of how to feel of how to do like a real blog. And then from there, if you feel like that web address is yours, then you go for yours. There are others, and you know, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with folks like Dan Meyer and others who were coming up around the same time. You can go ahead and venture into your own .com. Now, the thing with doing a .com, of course, is going to take a little bit of work on your end. It means getting your own, I guess, your own URL. You get your own hosting if you're into that. If you're somebody who wants to learn how to web design, there are free courses out there for that. Or, I mean, these days you can just throw on a template and see what's out there, see what's clean. It doesn't necessarily need to be anything like, again, like Dan's or mine or any other one, but I think there's so many platforms for you to do it with. What I do want to address, because the technical part is nice, but I think what matters really is that content. I think for so many math educators, we find ourselves in spaces where we almost feel like we have to be perfect. We have to be completely correct, much like our pedagogy, right? Like, we don't want to wrest power away from our voice when we're in the classroom. And what we've noticed lately is that, it's a different set of rules now. You know, kids do have access to the internet, and there's just so many more powerful things that are happening on the internet that often it feels like, wow, what I'm doing, if I'm just going to be completely dry and just say, okay, your answer is right, your answer is wrong, then it's going to disengage kids because it doesn't let them explore what they're doing, or at least give them a sense of ownership of what they're doing. And that is the same thing with our writing. I feel like if you come from a space where whatever you're saying is 100% right and there's no conversation, there's no dialogue, there's no reflection on your end, or even a sense that maybe you could be wrong on this and you want to be challenged on that, then it becomes harder to gain audience and it becomes harder for people to actually read you. And that's where I found the line between my favorite blogs and my least favorite blogs. Both blogs that I visit are the ones that the person who I'm reading feels like they're flawed. Like, they either want help or they're putting a practice out there that is not 100% foolproof, but they tried something that engaged a certain set of kids. And that's a powerful tool for math pedagogues out there. And of course, once you think about that writing and, you know, you start thinking, you take your time and you build that over time, I think people do get drawn to that. And, you know, you may get a few views, you may get like 100,000 views, you may get somewhere in between. And those of us who are lucky to get a few thousand views every so often, it's a blessing. But please do understand, I think what really matters is also that community. When you start writing for community versus just writing for yourself, you're still engaged in that same process of reflection, but then you're also engaging different voices and try to play around with ideas. And perhaps you're even trying to think about what your writing would look like if you put it, I don't know, in a book. Those of us who, again, written a book, I have. This is not a test, a new narrative on race, class, and education. The book itself, the book process came right out of the blog. I think you're going to notice throughout this presentation that, you know, everything is connected. So my blog was connected to my book because I formed my book out of a lot of the blogs that I wrote. And as I was thinking about my own math experience through my own childhood and how that connected to my own students, I started to see how writing a book was necessary because there were so few books that represented my experience as a math teacher. you go to any Barnes & Noble now, the few that are left, unfortunately, you go to any bookstore, there are very few books that actually are dedicated to the experience of a math teacher, a math professor, sure. Math people who have done things, perhaps, but an actual math K through 12 teacher, that's kind of hard to come by. So when I wrote my book, I did it from the sense of, if there's no book that represents my experience, I will write it. And I believe that there are enough people out there who will at least sympathize and not empathize with my experience. How many of you, for example, and this is a good question for you all to think about in the chat window, how many of you feel like too many people come up to you and say, you know, your job is too hard, I couldn't do it? This is a good question. It's for y'all to think about. How many of you feel, yeah. Right. And so, exactly. Now, look at the chat box now and consider too, right? Yes. Oh, you're amazing for teaching those kids. See, and like, look at the way that sentence was structured, right? There's the first part of, yes. There's that first part where people say, oh, you're amazing for teaching. That's that one piece where it's like, oh, look, shock and wonder, as if our world is strictly dedicated to, I guess, what we consider first-tier professions, like being a doctor, a lawyer, anyone like that. But then there's that part of those kids where you're like, oh, my goodness. Okay, so not only are you not thinking about our present situation with regards to education, you're also not very considerate of our future, because those kids are actually going to be the leaders for our society when we get older. We need to be a little bit more considerate. Yes, I will say this, as a middle school math teacher in 7th and 8th grade, I would tell you, yes, those are by far the most unstable years of our children's lives. And so it does take a special person to have anywhere between, 20 to 30 students that are still kind of working themselves out in a big classroom and trying to figure out who they are, what they are. It takes a special person to manage all that. And then there's a part of me, too, though, that makes me wonder if people only see things from the lens of who they were as a child, because there's that conversation too. Do they see themselves as still part of that classroom? Do they envision what middle school teaching might look like, or what high school teaching might look like, or any sort of teaching, right, from K to 12? Do they envision themselves in the classroom, seeing how those interactions would actually be powerful if they had folks who resonated with that, folks who understand what turmoil is like, and folks who are patient, who are kind, who are loving, who come into classrooms and say, hey, yes, we're going to learn math, but underneath that conversation of math is going to be love, respect, and care for all the kids that are there. So that's really dope. So now, I'm reading now, oh, don't you have issues with them when I say I teach in the Bronx? Yes, and of course we're going to have issues, right? We're going to have issues all the time, but I think what's interesting about that is some of us who have been teaching middle school for as long as we have, we know how to manage that because the kids are the kids. I think they blame this. Yes, you have to find ways to teach them responsibility, but at the end of the day, they are students. Like, they are our children, and we have to find a way to work with them. Now, let me ask Paula, if I see a hand raised, is this where people talk? Oh, okay. I just want to make sure. So if people have questions, they can feel free to throw them in. I think I saw a question earlier from Wendy about manuscripts, was it? Let me see. Yeah, so as far as, so she says, Jose, when did you get the idea to publish the book, while writing your blog, or did someone solicit a manuscript? The answer is way complicated. Here's what I'll say. I think I wanted to write a book because, again, like I told you, I went to Barnes & Noble in Union Square in New York City, and I looked at the education section and there were no books that were dedicated to my experience, not just as a man of color teaching middle school and Washington High School. That's a very specific experience. But even just as simple as, you know, being a math K through 12 teacher and one that didn't want to do it from a pedagogical standpoint. For those of you who are looking into writing books, for example, you'll notice that people these days are actually looking for pedagogues who just want to write about pedagogy. Everything's about resources, Common Core. If you can create any sort of like organizers, worksheets, that sort of stuff. There's a market for that. And there are people who will market it up and down because what a lot of the publishers do is they'll take a lot of those really big chunky books and then they'll sell them at $30 a pop to districts. So that's how they get their money back. But unfortunately, I also see because there's so many of them in the market and because they're so hungry for it, you lose out on the actual story. So there are a few books that I've read, for instance, that I felt like could have benefited from being grounded in the interaction between teacher and student and letting that interaction play within the writing. And even if it was completely flawed and you were like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that happened, which, by the way, happens a ton of times in my book. And there's some things I have to scrap out because of space or whatever. But the more powerful stories are the ones where teachers mess up. And then maybe the student also messes up. And then it may be a messy conclusion, but there may be some sort of lesson learned or gleaned from all that. And that's a powerful thing, too. So when I had my book and I put it all together, you know, it was supposed to be about 14 chapters. They were all parts of my blog. The publishers that were out there understood that I had some sort of following out there because looking at social media was still not as big a thing as it is right now. But people didn't quite understand just to the depth that people were hungry for that sort of thing. So I found myself trying to sell it over and over and over. And it took over 2 years learning how to sell manuscripts, learning how to work with agents and all that other stuff. I don't have one currently because I ended up just doing it myself. But I found a publisher, Haymarket Books, that actually wanted to publish my story from an angle of progressive, I guess, radicalism, if you will. But I think even more importantly in the story is that the radicalism comes out through the stories of the voices of the kids. That there's a sense that, yes, we can resist against what's even currently happening in education. And yet within that, there's all these, I guess, lenses of humanity. And I think that was my biggest push when I started writing. So I didn't want to do the instructional piece because that's just not my thing. I could do that whenever I want. But then what happens when you actually want to have a real introduction, a real question, things that you want to explore? So all those things matter. And I'm hoping that more people can write books like that. Okay. Yes, you can be a crazy person for doing that. I don't normally use the word crazy, but I've heard that quite a lot. I'm reading from Deborah. I teach mostly non-native English speakers, low income. Most people assume English language learners have cognitive deficits. Racism equals low expectations. Yes, and I think racism allows for people to not see the knowledges that our kids come with when they come into the classroom and you're trying to teach them math. One of the stories I like to tell, for example, is that my first year, I was trying to teach percents. And instead of using the word percent, because there's a couple Latin root words there, I actually translated it to por ciento. And for a lot of my students who are predominantly Spanish speakers, they connected with that word more when I taught percents because it was out of 100. So whenever they saw something out of 100, they immediately knew to connect it to percents. If I had thought that my students weren't as smart, perhaps I would have just said, you know what, percent, and that's all you need to know. But instead, I took advantage of their own knowledges and their own idea of what a percent would be in order for them to get a sense of what a percent was. And that's just, it sounds small, but then, you know, for the rest of the year, I was just able to say por ciento, and they got it. They were able to change things to decimal, fraction, et cetera. Like they saw it in multiple forms, all by me changing up some of the words and using those real and false cognates within their languages. But if we assume that they don't know anything when they walk into our doors, then we're already at a loss. We're already doing too much work. Okay. How do you carve out time to consistently write after teaching all day? Here's what I'd say. I think those of us who are teachers have a hard time finding any time to write. This is the way I would do it if I was you, and you, I mean every single one of you. I would take a Sunday and just let some ideas foment for a little bit. Maybe in the morning, start thinking about things that you want to write about and that you're generally interested in and that you think you may be able to write, I'll say 300 words. If you have an idea that you just kind of want to flesh out, that's a good day for you to do it, because Sunday is a real good day for any sort of writing. Then throughout the week, what I have found I'll say this, and this is before I had my five-year-old, because Alejandro is definitely a handful. I love him. I love every bit of fatherhood. But as far as his writing is concerned, I do have to find time to schedule. So somewhere between 7 and 9 o'clock is when I really get to writing, because that's when things are calming down. I thought about what I want to write over the day. There are times when I have like a really good idea, but I don't know how I'm going to frame it. And then over the course of the day, whenever like I'm walking around or I see evidence of things that I want to write, then I just start collecting all those things. And I say, okay, I want to include this. I want to include that. Oh, I read this. I want to pull that in. And then I get the time to just pull something out, maybe like 500 words that night. Now, if you find that you're not ready to 100% publish it, then don't do that, because that's gonna mess up your flow. But really, you're looking to see if you can collect enough evidence out there in the world to put something in a blog in a way that can connect to the reader. So I'm thinking something like 2 or 3 times a week is a good thing for you to do if you want to be a consistent math writer. The more time that you keep writing, the better you get at it. That goes with anything. But then on top of that, you also have to go read. So all those blogs that you saw in the box, you may want to start collecting some of those and really get a sense of reading them. And of course, there's also MTBOS on Twitter as well, if you're somebody who wants to do reading on math specifically. And of course, there's also EduColor, which has a lot of different blogs from all over the place. There are folks who just post really nice resources up there. And I'm privileged to say too that I had a hand in curating what the feed looks like. So we try to make sure that people who are putting things up on the EduColor hashtag are actually putting things that are of quality, so people can actually read. So that's that. What else? Let's see. I'm seeing a question around, how long had you been writing before you decided to write a blog? Oh my goodness. My people, I've been writing a blog anonymously and with my name for the better part of 15 years. Holy cow. Kella aging me. How old am I? Yeah. Just about then. So, I'm going to talk right about that. Paula, thank you for that. Yes. So I think it's taken a long time for me to get where I am as far as my writing. The way that I started really was, again, anonymous, just trying to turn things out, experimenting with different flows and different ways of writing and seeing how they work. I once was a slam poet at some point in my life too, so I got acclimated to how to work with different vibes, different vibrations, how the mouth works, what it's like to read aloud versus what it's like to type things, and how that sounds to different people. I think that's an important task for everyone to take on. If you can actually read aloud the things that you write, it actually makes your writing better too. Now, as far as Paula asked, so are you saying that you get inspired by reading other people's stuff? The answer is absolutely yes. Everyone should be reading other people's things. As a matter of fact, 2/3 of writing is actually reading. So anything from just reading blogs, Obviously, one of my favorites, Ta-Nehisi Coates, is a good read at all times. But there are random things that I'll read, too, that I'll pick up. For those of you who are familiar, Zadie Smith, Roxane Gay, those are people I'm thinking of off the top of my head. I'm even thinking about The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon. That's my favorite math book out there ever of all time. I'm going to have to pop something in the box about that, aren't I? The Curious Incident. Okay. I'm assuming most of you read it already, but if you have not, it's a gorgeous, gorgeous book, and I think it connects very deeply to the work that we do as math educators. Let me, poop. Okay. See that. So there's that. Those are books, and of course, again, articles, keep reading, but also your fellow math bloggers. Like, why not go comment? And some, the powerful thing about commenting too is that when you comment, and you find yourself on a day that you just, you don't want to, write your own thing. If you go and comment, you at least are still in the writing process. So you are responding. There was a era for about 5 or 6 years where people who blogged would say, oh, I read this article and here's what I thought. Like, in my mind, that's a comment. But if you decide that you don't want to do that sort of thing in your own blog, go comment everybody else's blogs. Go find spaces where they have built community and people are responding to what you're saying. All those things really matter. So here's Wendy and the great look into the mind. Yeah. So yes, that Mark Haddon book, excellent. What else? Yes. Oh, so, I talked about the book, and again, feel free to keep asking about books. Keep asking about blogs. Let me also say too, because this is about to connect to Paula's piece right here. Consider that all your social media, as far except for like the family-friendly Facebook that you have, should be connected to whatever you're writing. Because I find that if you find synchronicity with all the things that you're doing, whether you have like a Facebook fan page, if you have a Twitter, if you have an Instagram, those of you who are on Pinterest, anybody on Pinterest, because that seems to be a powerful space. Then anytime that you tweet and anytime that you like post a picture or do whatever it is, people start remembering that, yes, you write and you have thoughts that you want to get out. I find that Twitter is a really nice space for me to get feedback before I start writing. So there are times, for instance, those of you who follow me on Twitter, and if you don't, please do. if on Twitter, I may rant on something, like I may throw out about 4 or 5 tweets. If I find that those tweets aren't connecting with people, then maybe I need to go back and not write about what it is that I was going to write about. However, and as is often the case, if people are responding to the idea on Twitter, then I feel even more empowered to go write about it as an article. I think it's a powerful tool to use, because Twitter is a fairly good space for you to get good feedback on things that you're thinking. It's good for you to cultivate people who you think not only have like minds, but will also, talk to you and respond to you. So I'm blessed because I have about 2,000 folks who I follow personally, and I want to read their stuff, want to ingest what they have to say. And then, they're responsive too on my notification. So if I have something that I think they think is way off, then they'll let me know as well. And I'm humble enough to take that. So you have to build those communities, and you keep building them up. And as a matter of fact, they keep sharing with you too, right? So that's good advice for anybody, I'd say. Next, there are questions about my writing in the workplace. How many of you fear writing anything too dangerously, or writing period, like in the public? How many of you fear for your own jobs? Okay, that's one. One of you fears it out of 10. You don't fear. I like to explore that a little bit, Wendy. I like to explore that a little bit. Our conversations have been fruitful on that. Yes, indeed, indeed. I think administrators can be kind of callous when it comes to this stuff. And yeah, the contract will not protect us. It will not. Frankly, our unions don't protect bloggers like that. And there's a fear on their end as well. Okay. I'm seeing the plus one, yeah, and non-like-minded colleagues, right? Okay, so I mean, not that I need to mind everyone's political aspirations or thoughts here, but she said, but I also dare my admin to be unpleasant to me. Oh my goodness, you guys are amazing. Yeah. So here's what I'm gonna say to y'all. And again, anybody who's followed me for the better part of 7 or 8 years knows that I am blocked from all computers in New York City public schools except for Central. Now, I first found out about that about 3 to 4 years into my blogging, and at that point, well, I don't know if Bill de Blasio does or Carmen Farina, but I have a feeling that, well, I have an inclination that some of them do. Let me get back to the story. So when I found out about it, I was at first like, okay, it's just my school, no problem. And then I just started asking, you know, random folks out there, hey, is your blog blocked out there? And they'd say no. And then they said, oh, wait a minute, let me go check yours. And they say yes. And it just popped up. Like, I had stories left and right all over New York City of people who told me that my blog was blocked in different spaces. So I thought it was just my school or maybe like somebody else's school, not like the entire district of New York City. So that really blew my mind because at first I thought it was just because I cussed too much. And I've tempered that down a whole lot since I first started, mind you, because there were people who frankly were a little sensitive, and those are the folks who I actually wanted to read. There were a couple of folks like Renee Moore, for instance, blogging hero of mine. Let me write her name in. Who said, I probably don't need to cuss as much if I want her to read my blog. So I said, okay, I'm going to chill out just for you. But even then, and, you know, they do things like categorize my website as social media or whatever it was. So this whole thing about fake news, believe it or not, has affected me way before Trump became president. Now, I'd also say, too, that as I kept writing, I said, okay, like, I'm going to keep doing this anyway. And it became, frankly, a point of selling for a lot of people. I said, oh, snap, like, I need to go read your blog because I want to go find out what you have to say that's got so many administrators in Central uptight. And then something happened about 3 years ago where I was invited into this workshop for Central DOE. At that time, I was still about 8 years deep, if I'm not mistaken, into blogging under my own name. And I was still I'm still teaching. I'm still a teacher. I've been a teacher full time. And then I went to this workshop to be a presenter. I thought I had some fairly pleasant things to say. And then after the workshop was done, one of the people from Central says, oh my goodness, that was a great presentation. I said, wait, does everybody here know me? And it was a meeting full of network leaders and it was every superintendent in the city, every network leader in the city. So a lot of the big boys were there. The outgoing chancellor was there as well. And they said, yes, like everybody reads you. The thing that you should know though is that some people read you because they love you and some people read you because they love to hate you. And I said, oh my gosh, that is some really good information. At first, I was really disappointed because I thought at that point, we had gone beyond the pettiness of writing. I just found like of writing against or pro whatever policy and really talking about kids. I didn't really have that much backing from my union. Yes, my first book party was at the UFT, but I didn't find that they were super responsive to me blogging, or at least to the point where I thought that they vocally state like, hey, DOE needs to relax a little bit and let this man have his opinion. He has a First Amendment right. I didn't find that sort of thing. So for those of you who are blogging dangerously, my suggestion to you is keep writing any old way. If you're blogging because you truly care about students and you want to see progress, and as a math teacher, you're still getting out there, you're making your voice known, and you're delving into the experiences that educators like you and I go through on a daily basis, then keep writing, because we really need you out there. And that's my point. And I think so many folks have benefited from having someone put all their experiences out there. So many teachers who are new because they read my stuff and said, oh, snap, I can be a teacher too. But I can't do it alone. NYC Educator can't do it alone. There's a bunch of other bloggers who are out there that put their voices out there, and we really need more bloggers out there. So that's my end of it. Any other questions as we get to the 9:41 mark? Questions, thoughts? I'm listening. Let me see. Okay. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, you should know there is an activity Frank Shorn has just put up. Let me go check it out right quick. Oh, I think you need to check the link, sir. So let me see. Yeah. Not feeling alone. Again, I ask, how many of you feel alone in your district as far as this sort of work? It was stunning to me that despite how many people at Twitter Math Camp, for example, had anywhere from 300 followers to about like 20,000 followers just off resources they posted at their own school, they felt isolated. And really the only thing that helped them stay in the profession was teaching and writing about teaching. So it can be very siloing in a way. Anyone else? I see one person is definitely in a silo. Anyone else? Most feel siloed where they're at. Give us some time. Because I got one more thing before I want to contribute. Good time. Okay, so here's this too. So is anyone out there interested in writing a book or co-writing a book? Maybe that's a good question for people for me to ask. Okay, that's two people who are interested in writing a book. Okay. Yes. Okay. So there's, okay, wait. Can y'all hear me? You can hear me? Okay, good. All right. So here's a couple things everyone should know. If you're going to do it from a personal standpoint, it's going to be harder to sell your book. Because again, so few folks in the market want, stories from people who are currently teaching. I hope I've opened some doors in that, but I'm hoping that if you do get out there, you can at least use some of my work to say, hey, like, there have been successful books like the one I'm thinking about. Not to mention there's a few other ones that I can probably link later on. I can just share with all of you. Wait. Okay. That was weird. Done. Yeah. Okay. That's weird. All right. So, you can either do it from the personal perspective or from the professional perspective. If you want, So what I mean by personal is that how many of you have noticed the upsurge of books from people who recently quit and then like left for whatever reason. I think that's a big deal, right? So there are folks who write the books and they'll say, oh yeah, like, you know, I went through this classroom. I did it for 1 year. And, yeah, there's a plethora of that. And that's okay. There's so many books out there that just say, hey, like, I've done this already. And this is what I found in my 1 or 2 years of teaching. And I came here to save the kids. It's a bit disingenuous in a way, right? Versus those of us who do stay, we're not fortunate enough to have our books sold that way, or we may not have the connections. So there are two ways to approach that. Either you can follow my template, which was, you know, try to find that publisher that, yes, there are very short articles like that too, right? You can either do it, again, my way, which is just like, get a bigger following, try to be consistent with your writing, show that you have the chops for the writing too. Try to find spaces that'll be open to your message. Education Week is a pretty powerful space. Even the Atlantic, you know, believe it or not, they do have people who support the writing if you have the chops. There's other blogging networks out there that I think everyone can access if they find a way. And of course, using the power of the collective MTBOS. I think there's still something to be said for having that many teacher bloggers tuned in. And if we can find a way to harness more leaders within them in that space, then I think it's going to be easier to say, hey, like, I have a book and I can tap into all these friends and colleagues right here. And let's build off that. So that's on the personal end. Of course, you can also independently publish, but that's going to take a little bit more traction on your end. That's going to take a lot more work if you don't go without a publisher. If you do the professional route, I found this super easy to do it. There are spaces, for instance, like ASCD, like Heinemann, that are looking for specific type of books, but you do have to know somebody to know somebody. So acquisitions editors will probably ask for the last person for the cover letter, the last for a sample chapter, and then they'll probably ask for how you're going to approach the writing and the resources pieces, right? And who exactly can you market to? So, for example, if you're somebody right now who still only has a couple hundred followers on Twitter, that seems to be the first thing people look at. And I know it sounds shallow, but you're probably going to need to pick that up a bit. And again, point of personal privilege is what I've heard so many times. And I'm more than willing to help out with that as well. I'm just putting it out there. But then there's also, too, the actual writing. So I'm seeing that a lot of you are actually reading. Good on you. Go read from the authors that you want to sound like. That kind of sounds weird, but it's not like you're emulating per se. You may start like emulating at first, really, but then you start building your own style off of the things that you read and see. And I think from there, then it becomes really easy to get sharp about how you want to approach your stuff. So Elena Aguilar, for example, she wrote the book, The Art of Coaching. That took a little while for her to write. But what I found with her book is that she built it up because that was a small segment that wasn't being taken care of. Being a teacher coach is, as like an instructional coach, is a really hard thing to do if you don't have the proper supports within your staff, within administration, within the district. So she wrote a whole series of books based on that. Her first book did really well, and then from there, she was able to build a mass following just based off the resources she had already had there. And at first, it's like, yeah, like, I want to give these resources for free, but then I also want to keep some of these in my back pocket just in case I think they can have a larger effect on pedagogy. And I think that's a good approach for any professional book. Thank you for posting the link there. Let's see. Yes. Did you have your book all written before you submitted to potential publishers? The answer is no, not at all. Let me tell you, like, you think you know how to write a book when you put the manuscript together. Like, I thought I was a pretty good writer when I put my book together. And I sent it to, like, I had a good 10 to 15 folks, my friends, who all know how to write. They all read it and they said, oh my goodness, this is good. Like, you're really gonna do well, yada, yada. And then when I gave it to the publisher said, yeah, we're gonna take this because we know it has potential, but we're gonna have a lot of work to do as far as putting it into something that is a real world book. Because there's a difference between saying it's a nice collection of essays versus a seamless experience for the reader to feel. They had originally aimed for my book to be 185 pages, which I thought I should at least be past 200 just to make it a nice, rich experience for the reader. Once I handed in the original manuscript, between that time and the time I met my editor, who had edited a whole bunch of really powerful books herself, non-education books, mind you, but real powerful books, she just looked at it and said, okay, here's all the things we need to fix. Here's all the things I decided to cut. And my book was whittled down from 185 pages to 165 pages from the manuscript. And so I replied to her like, hey, I really want to have a bigger book than this. It shouldn't be that thin. So she just shrugged and said, okay, so we're going to do this. And I just became a better writer through the process. I mean, when you have an editor just sit down with you and say, okay, here's what I want to hear more about. Here's the thing that I have questions about. Here's what you actually need to do some work on. And then going through all that, and mind you, on a personal note, my father had passed away, I think the day after Nelson Mandela had passed away, and I forgot what else had happened. So that week, it was just, I wanted to quit writing. So it was a wild experience throughout that time. And things were happening with my editor as well. And then at some point at mid December, I said, okay, you know what? Like, I'm 3/4 of the way there. All I need to do is kick butt. And Christmas break came. I just started kicking butt, throwing out all the pages. And by, I'd say, late January to early February, I had my book pretty much together. I think I even made a little bit of history in the Chicago style guide, like the style manual guide, because some a reference to the Notorious B.I.G., and whether I should be putting dots or no dots between the B, the I, and G. So I have a little piece of history along with my book. I love telling people that. But moral of the story, it's going to take a while for you to actually write a book. And then when you hand in the book, there's this second level of writing a book that you also need to pay attention to, because it's so much quicker and it's so much more it takes a lot more work with your mind than you have than you could have possibly imagined. So there's that as well. Anyone else? Oh goodness, you have 7 minutes left. I went by kind of quickly. Y'all are kind of, you're so cool. What else we got? Questions, comments, thoughts. I welcome them all. Yeah. So it's B-I-G. And the way that Notorious B-I-G spells it, I believe it's like that. And the Chicago style manual said, nah, you're not supposed to do it that way. And we put in an inquiry and I said, no, we're actually going to do it this way. And yeah, now they allow it. Yay. See, I mean, and as far as writing, and again, if you're doing a book, you have to let go of your ego to a point. I think there was a big mental battle for me where I was fighting with the editor, like, why don't you want this in there? Like, I need the people who this is about to know that they are in this book. But if it doesn't flow with the story, then some sacrifices have to be made. It is a compromise. As long as you don't compromise the actual message of the book, right? So if I found, for instance, that This Is Not a Test became a book about, I guess, some real soft stuff, then I would not I would not publish it. I would not put it out there. If I found that it didn't hit the mark as far as the love and empathy that I have for students, along with this radical inclination towards changing the way I taught and the way I delivered and the things I was doing outside of school, if it deviated from any personal principle that I had about the way I viewed education, then I wouldn't do it. So there were a couple publishers, for example, and I told you about this earlier. They wanted me to change This Is Not a Test to a more resource type of book. And I just said, we have a lot of resource type books already. Like, we already have what the first day of school should look like, what the second day of school should look like. We probably even have books out there about what the last day of school should look like. And I don't want any of that because there's plenty of books that are like that out there. I'd rather just speak from a place of principle, from a place of love and heart, and try to get to the point where teachers feel like, yes, I can actually do this thing. And these are the things that make me flawed as a person. But my hope for anybody is that once they read the book, they feel like, yeah, like either that they can do this teaching thing or that they at least have a better understanding and won't say to me, you're wild for doing this profession. Well, how soon before I write another one? The answer is, I am currently working on two. So in my mind, I actually probably have like three or four books, but there are two that were specifically pitched to me, both of which I'll put it out there. I haven't been able to touch because of the things that have happened in the last few months. But there will be two books, one that is super topical, and I'm trying to focus it in on grit. So, and this was one by a major publisher. So I'm like, yes, let's do this. That should be powerful. And the second one is more leaning towards, like, I guess my personal view of the complicated nature of teaching in this era. And it's not going to come from what some might consider the dire and ravage way of doing things, which is like, I'm just going to rebut every single thing with research. It's more like, let me make this super complicated for you all, and this is not going to have a conclusion, but I want you to come away with the idea that our job is super hard, and I want you to respect it a whole lot more than society currently does right now. So, oh, wait, I think I just came up with something. That's awesome. Thank you. So that's where I'm at. I have two of them, and I'm hoping that they're – oh, can't me neither. I cannot wait. I'm going to have some real good things to say in all of that. And I'm hoping that you all will purchase when they do come out, hopefully by next year. Anything else? As far as writing, as far as book, blog, Twitter. Since we have about 2 minutes left, is that what it is? Wendy, thank you. And oh, I should also plug, too, the thing that I found that's been awesome about working with Wendy is that because she's so organized, it lets me be a better human being for the people in the room. If you're somebody who's a facilitator, that's a good thing for you to do if you want to become a better writer, because you are actually not just facilitating thoughts, you're also going into the minds of the people who are going to read you. And at some point you say to yourself, yeah, like that's kind of the note I wanted to hit as somebody who's out there. Done. Yay. If you have any other questions, I am available to everyone on Twitter at the JLV or at my website, as always, thejosegosen.com. Y'all are the best. Thank you so much. I'm not going to be on Twitter for the week, but if you still feel inclined, my email is 100% open. So thanks, y'all.
So thank you, Jose. That was extremely inspirational. And you answered a lot of questions, so we much appreciate that. I hope this inspires, especially that first person who said they were thinking about blogging, to actually start blogging. We definitely need more voice from math teachers, that's for sure. So I just, for all of you who are still here, I am going to stop the recording. I have a feeling that Jose's willing to stay around a few more minutes if you want to ask more questions. Again, in approximately 2 hours, I would say, you can come back and listen to the